All right, if you're anything like me, you hate running out of food on a trip. It's like a big fear. And so I'm a big fan of snacks during an adventure. And one of my absolute favorite go-to snacks are Wonderful Pistachios. You may be familiar with pistachios and the brand Wonderful Pistachios, but if you're not, they are one of the highest protein nuts out there. 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios is 6 grams of protein. That's 10% of your daily value. It also includes 9 essential amino acids, and they come with a ton of different flavors, varieties. There's a spicy version, there's lightly salted, there's no salted, there's so many. And every time I go on an adventure, I'm not even lying, I take an entire bag with me. And what's cool too, I love having the Wonderful Pistachio in shell, because then that almost gives me something to do and focus on as I'm paddling or biking through the really monotonous parts of the adventure. Every great adventure is going to have plenty of boring moments, and it's nice to have something to do and also something that is giving you some fuel, like Wonderful Pistachios. So they're one of my favorite adventure snacks, favorite road trip snacks, and definitely leave me feeling better than a lot of other snacks you can turn to. So if you want to learn more about how to fuel your next adventure with Wonderful Pistachios, go to WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason Gravely. Today's episode is with the author, Will Cockrell, about the industry of climbing Mount Everest. A lot of you may think, oh yeah, Everest, there's kind of two sides of the spectrum here. A lot of people are like, oh, I still want to, you know, Everest is the pinnacle of adventure, and that's the goal, my biggest item on my bucket list. And others are like, you know, we pretty much have Everest figured out. It's a trashed mountain. There's debris everywhere. There's dead bodies. I have no desire to do that from an adventure point of view. And you might know that infamous photo of the Everest traffic jam from 2019, where like 200 people were trying to get to the summit, and it just basically looked like a long line into a restaurant or something. It was crazy. Just tons of people waiting to walk on the summit, take a picture, and then walk down. Well, the truth is, the state of the mountain is somewhere in between those. And what Will is doing today is going to tell us about what really is going on. What is the history behind this industry? The beauty of the Himalayan expedition and guiding industry, and how the future of Everest will probably return to a much more sacred, a much more adventurous experience, and probably get that status back to a lot of us of being a really sought after adventure location, because it is that, you know, all the sensationalism around Everest having a tons of poop on it and tons of bodies and tons of debris. Yes, that is true, but that's only part of the truth. It's still an incredible place. And this book, Everest Inc., is going to dive into that truth. So just like we do with a lot of the authors we have on the show, we are going to be giving away a free copy of the book. All you got to do is message me in one of the ways listed. Email, Mason@AdventureSportsPodcast.com, Instagram, Adventure Sports Podcast, or Facebook Messenger, or if you got my number, text me, but I'm not going to put that on air. But one of those three ways, get a hold of me, tell me you want a copy of Everest Inc., and I will enter you into a list. If I select you, I'll randomly select after 24 hours, and if you are selected, I will notify you and send you a copy of the book. We did this last week, and it was awesome, so congrats to the person that won. And let's go ahead and dive in. Well, hey, folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. Today we're talking to Will Cockrell, and I want to say I love the book title. It's very intriguing, Everest Inc. I don't know if you thought of that or someone else did, but I am sure when that popped into your head, you're like, that's it. That's what it feels like to me. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks. No, I'm stoked to be here. I appreciate it, Mason. That title, funny enough, has been with this project since like the very first time I thought about it. In fact, it's one of those titles, I think, that when I did think of it, having covered Everest a lot in my life and my career, I'm like, surely there's a book called Everest Inc. Surely, you know, that's been thrown. And I'm sure there's been a million magazine articles maybe with that title. It's not like I invented it. But with my aim being for this to come out into the world as sort of like the book for understanding Everest, I'm really proud and glad that that's the title of the book, because it kind of says it all about the modern era on the mountain.
The business of the mountain, like what is this industry surrounding it? So, I guess I'd ask this, what was your goal with the book? Like what kind of story are you trying to tell? What kind of perspective are you trying to bring to the average person? Because the average person isn't going to climb Everest.
You know, I feel like having covered the mountain for a long time as a journalist and being a climber myself, I always recognize the nuances in the big splashy stories that we've all seen. For example, remember, I mean, there's the photo everyone calls the conga line, was like, you know, 2019, just people lined up at the summit. It just looks dangerous, irresponsible, aesthetically not pleasing, right, for people who are into mountains and the outdoors. I always had a feeling that it was way more complex than what was ever revealed in the reporting on Everest. It way more nuanced. And in fact, I always often felt like some of these stories were even just being reported flat out wrong or being misconstrued or feeding into a narrative that we all already have, that the mountain is crowded, dangerous, and spoiled.
Yeah. Dirty, covered in poop. You know what I mean? Those stories have been told. Yeah.
Right. And then there was this counter narrative going on in my life as a reporter and a climber. I knew a lot of mountain guides. I knew a lot of guides who climbed on Everest. I had met people who had climbed Everest. I knew serious mountaineers who had done it. And I knew people who had never climbed who had done it. And I started to see these things. And I felt like all of a sudden I realized that I was close enough to what goes on that mountain that I realized I meet a lot of really good, well-spoken people around that industry, Nepali and Western, who there's some stewardship around Everest that is just like very cool, that I thought, how come no one knows any of that? And I thought, well, geez, you know, I thought everyone knew everything about Everest, including myself. And I thought, gee, that's a pretty compelling story.
What do you think one of the first things that comes to mind as far as putting this into perspective for the average person? Like, what are one of those first nuances you wanted to try to get across? Like, hey, this is still a real adventure, or this, the conga line's the very end of the goal. Like, the rest of it's still this huge 70-day door-to-door experience for a lot of people. Like, it's not an easy thing to do. Like, what was like that low-hanging fruit you wanted to try to get across?
I think the two biggest things that sort of built my book into being a counter narrative, probably the two anchors of that, one being that our early narrative was largely shaped by what I'll call, when I refer to in the book sometimes as real climbers, but that's sort of the unfair way to put it, but mountaineers of principle who've been doing it their whole life, who believe that self-sufficiency in the mountains is really what it's all about, and that you might hire a guide, but it's only to learn more skills so that you never have to hire a guide again. And so John Krakauer being one of those types of climbers, right? John Krakauer's background, he's a badass. I mean, that guy's done a lot of really amazing climbing. He's a fantastic climber and journalist. But he came to Everest as one of those people who is shaping our understanding of the mountain from a climber's perspective. And there was a moment, I open with the moment surrounding Dick Bass, for example, when Everest began to morph from being a climber's objective to being more like the Grand Canyon. right? In other words, everybody's sort of aspiration. There was something that happened when people started to say, so you don't have to be a climber to climb Everest. You just have to want it badly enough, muster everything you have in you, go there knowing why you're doing it, you know, all these things. And so it shifted. It's not a climber's objective anymore. And that might open your mind to looking at it a little differently, right? That will potentially say, well, it's crowded for a climbing objective. As a climber, if I saw that many people on top of Mount Rainier or something, I would be put off. But maybe not as a weekend warrior who went to climb Rainier once, which so many hundreds of people do every summer, and it's life-changing. Even a mountain like Mount Rainier, they never go climb another mountain, but that weekend sticks in their mind for the rest of their lives. Imagine Everest. And then the one other thing that sort of helped me build, or the backbone of that counter narrative, is really the Sherpa piece. Again, I'd say this has changed within my own career, my own lifetime, professionally and personally, where the Sherpas were once definitely cut as victims. They were, you know, their story was told. The colonialization, the colonial undertones were just too sort of overwhelming to ignore. The fact that all these Westerners were doing business in this country and dictating, and they were doing the lower jobs, et cetera. Well, that has changed drastically in the last 10 years, drastically. And the Nepalis more or less own the industry now, and they're stewards for the industry. And the level of passion and skills among them is very similar to the Westerners back when they started the industry there. And that's really that's a really uplifting narrative, in my opinion. So anybody who says, you know, oh, it's BS, you know, you go there and they put you put 200 pounds on the Sherpa's back and send them up ahead of you to the dangerous part. That's very off base. That's very off base.
What is it more like now then? What's the reality of it today?
Well, so the turning point, I don't know if you remember this from the book, was or something that no one had ever reported on or ferreted out from the Sherpa experience, was talking to the longtime Sherpas, the one who'd been there since the very beginning. And they all admitted that when the mountain started getting busier, more clients, they all talked about how they did not have the training to be called a guide. They had no medical training. They weren't really versed in some of the climbing rescue stuff, which are really complex, the knots. And Westerners, Europeans, largely Americans, Kiwis, Australians, they do like a graduate school degree and get where they want to become a real mountain guide. It's insane. And the Sherpas always got stuck in a certain role because they were not mountain guides. And that was actually even a misconception even before that. People have said things like, well, wait a minute, didn't Tenzing Norgay guide Hillary to the top in 1953? There's people who switch it, who say, no, Hillary actually guided, you know, Hillary was the more experienced climber and guided Tenzing Norgay. Both are wrong. The Sherpas recognized that they were not mountain guides. And if you're going to climb Everest and you don't have experience, you need to be with a trained mountain guide. Like, I mean, that part of it, it would be irresponsible if you're inexperienced to climb with an untrained climber, which either Sherpa or Western. And basically what happened is a lot of the Westerners who own these companies that employed these Sherpas, who were just incredible human beings on so many levels. They were super strong physically. They had saved countless lives just with their sort of, I'm going to use the word loyalty to their profession. And they were just missing that one piece. And a lot of the Western guides started fostering that training. Conrad Anker started something called, and his wife, Jenny Lo Anker, started the Khumbu Climbing Center, which is in Fort Say. They actually sent a lot of these Sherpas back to the States to do trainings. And then all of a sudden, Nepal is allowed a track, like a lot of countries, for an IFMGA certification. That's the pinnacle. That's the top. That's the best mountain guiding certificate you can get. And there's a track in Nepal for achieving that. And a bunch of Nepali climbers are now IFMGA guides. So when you pay a Nepali company, one of the good ones, and you go there and you get put with a guide, it's just like basically going to a Western company, one of the legacy companies that I write about early on in the book.
From the sounds of it, it's the first few generations of Everest climbing experiences and companies in kind of these challenges that have been facing these stigmas and cliches are kind of growing pains. I almost feel like the industry's maturing and like entering, like that was its challenges through infancy. Like it's brand new and it's actually has a very hopeful future. It might return back to this climbing challenge that has the prestige and has the desire of many, and not just because I feel like a lot of people, just the average person, might think that the days of climbing Everest are over, you know, as far as the prestige of it, just because
as far as a climbing challenge goes,
exactly.
Like
yes.
As a climb mountaineer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, you can finish what you're saying. I can tell you why that's not quite true as well, but go ahead.
From the way you're putting it, it's like, no, we're really, there's been a lot we've learned through these first few generations. And now we're going to be entering a much more sustainable, respected and higher quality experience from here on out. Is that true?
Oh, it's absolutely true. And it's true on two levels. It's really interesting because, you know, I often try to remind people that when Jon Krakauer did go to the mountain, granted, this is on the assumption that we're saying Into Thin Air, his book about his experience that came out in 1997, he was on the mountain in 1996, shaped a lot of how we feel about the mountain, right? Let's assume, I think that's true. Jon Krakauer arrived on Everest 4 years after the first successful person had been guided to the top. The industry was 4 years old when he came to the mountain. Growing pains, the audacity of even thinking you can guide and experience people to the top of Everest is a preposterous idea. It took the early 90s. It took about 4 or 5 years for them to figure it out. And one thing that Krakauer was witnessing was growing pains. I mean, there were some bad decisions made that day, but growing pains. But what's interesting is that this is happening again. I'm not sure how many people are aware that last year was the deadliest season on Everest in history.
In history.
It's really strange to think that you know, especially even someone who reads my book, that, you know, might walk away saying, oh, great, you know, it's safe, we're on our way. But here's the thing. Since the Nepalis have taken over the industry, they are now experiencing a new set of growing pains that have a lot to do with their home country. You know, the fact that they're trying to get things done, the bureaucracy of Nepal, the fact that it's a developing country, and rules are a little hard to enforce. We're seeing it again. If you wanted to put it into one bucket, you could argue that several of the deaths last year were preventable, definitely preventable, but reflect some issues that are hopefully and supposedly being worked out.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. Are you looking to sell anything at all online? Well, I would advise you to look into Shopify. They are a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. I use Shopify every day at my day job. It has been with us since our company was a tiny little team all the way up to where we are today, one of the biggest breweries in the country. Whether you're auctioning off autographed apparel, selling sleek skis, or selling non-alcoholic beer like we are at Athletic Brewing, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their personal POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. We manage a podcast, a blog, all that right there on our Shopify store. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and has extensive help resources whenever you're dealing with an obstacle. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ASP, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ASP for Adventure Sports Podcast now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ASP.
That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
through your research and deep dive into the industry of Everest, what was a story that really surprised you that maybe just didn't see coming as far as a perspective or an individual or just a story that came out of the building of this industry? Because, yeah, of course, you know a lot going into it. You don't know everything.
No, it started early, and it's what got me fired up, I think, even more fired up to write the book. Again, it was, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And I learned early on the very early years of considering guiding it. I had no idea that they were still torn over this idea by, say, 1989, 1990, right? All the legacy guides from around that time that I spoke to, I basically pushed them to saying, okay, you know, it was something audacious. It was kind of ridiculous. You were getting a lot of flack from peers about it. Who pushed through and how, you know? So hearing the guides and the guide company owners from that time, basically talking about exactly how they started to put in motion the idea of putting a client on the top and the obstacles that they faced in doing so. I mean, people just thought it was absolutely crazy to add that to your menu of peaks. Oh yeah, we'll take you up Mount Rainier. We'll take you up Mont Blanc. We'll take you up Everest. People thought it was bonkers. And to hear people talk about their trepidation or fear, some of these guys like Eric Simonson, who owns International Mountain Guides, basically questioning every day, should I be doing this? Right. And I think that question, as soon as you remove the greed misconception, right? Everest is a lost leader for almost all these companies. As soon as you remove that misconception about, oh, well, of course they added it. They're making a ton of money. They're not. Mountain guides are a different breed of people, and they wanted to get inexperienced people to the top of that mountain. And they tried to figure it out. And then when it finally happened, there were a couple attempts there in the early 90s. When it finally happened, paying clients got to the summit, simultaneously clients of Alpine Ascents International and Adventure Consultants. Adventure Consultants being the company that was made famous in Into Thin Air. That day in spring of 1992, what's really interesting is that most of those owners of the legacy companies and those guides, they don't know what the first was. They didn't know. They were aware they were all trying it, but they weren't aware of, well, who got the first paying client? You know, someone the reason why that's important is because, you know, it's explicit. You're paying for them to be responsible for your safety. And folks, you know, when I kind of zeroed in on who that was and how it happened, everyone was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize it. They thought it had happened sooner was the main thing. That was all new territory for me. And it was exciting to hear because I just assumed it was a business move. Yeah, sure. Add Everest. Why not?
Right. It's just not that easy. There's a lot more.
Yeah, it's an insane proposition, right? The mountain was so hard to climb, and the mountain is so dangerous once you get above 8,000 meters into a zone no other mountain has. That's just, I mean, you know, I write in the book that it was once considered suicidal.
Think Everest is on the right track to return back to the prestige that it deserves as the world's tallest mountain? Or is it headed that way?
Well, it's already changed dramatically in that sense, right? We already can kind of all agree that it's not a climber's objective so much anymore. Although there are climbers who do know, like no one's made a solo winter ascent, for example. And there are certain faces on that mountain that have never been climbed. And there are some ridiculously amazing climbers, Simone Moro, the Italian who's climbed it a bunch, who flat out says, oh, there's plenty that can still be done on Everest. That's cutting edge climbing, but that's pretty in the weeds. Like you got to be a climber to understand why that matters. So I think it's fair to say that it has moved on from being a climber's mountain. Now whether that reduces, I don't know. If you're not a climber, I don't think it would, but I will say this, that it is true that there are fewer Westerners, fewer Americans, Kiwis, Europeans signing up to climb it, guide it. The business is down among Westerners because the mountain is seen as too easy now. Not too easy, but as too straightforward or done too much. So Westerners have actually pulled back. As usual, you know, we fail to look beyond the West a little too much. And again, looking at those Nepali companies, business is booming among Chinese and Malaysian because it's more affordable. And all of a sudden, these markets, because they're, I don't know if it has to do with the fact that some of the, that a lot of these guiding companies are Nepali or Asian owned, right? These are other Central Asians. And there may be something that draws other Asians, you know.
I mean, proximity, one.
Yeah, exactly. Proximity, price point, maybe the setup at base camp. I'm not sure. But
yeah.
But the point being that there's fewer Westerners who find the prestige, but that there's like other booming sectors and countries.
And also, you know, we can't forget it's also the tallest mountain in China because yeah. they share a border. So, you know, there's something about Denali is still popular with Americans, I can imagine.
Yeah.
And so there's something there, too. So what would you say? How about maybe not Everest being is being considered, quote, easy or too structured for a lot of climbing
yeah.
objectives? Are there surrounding mountains where that kind of that Everest ink has influence or has, you know, it's not just Everest, but all the surrounding 8,000 meter peaks and other mountains in the Himalayas that are still a destination and still a climbing objective? Do you see a brighter future or more attention being spent on those? I ask because here in the States, a lot of mountains that get attention are the 14,000 foot mountains, but you can go across a valley to a 13,000 or something besides Denali, and there's no one there, and it's a much better adventure or outdoor experience for a lot of people. So obviously the Himalayas, there's a lot more there than just Everest. Do you see a bigger future for some of those other surrounding mountains?
I do. It will be really interesting to see if the public, what their appetite for this is, but I can tell you right now that a lot of guiding companies offer a first ascent in Nepal.
Wow.
So, you know, because there are so many unclimbed mountains, 5,000 meter peaks, 6,000 meter peaks, right? In that range, as a guide, you can actually offer an unclimbed peak as a product. To me, that's even better than doing a 13 or, right, or whatever in the state. I mean, to go to a first ascent is awesome. And again, the beauty, depending on whether you're a hardcore climber or not, is that just because it's a first ascent doesn't mean it's death-defying. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean that it's just so hard that you'll probably die. It just means that nobody's gone to it.
Wow. So there's that many peaks still left to climb that they can just offer that. Unbelievable.
Not many are doing it. It's not like a common thing, but there's a handful.
Yeah, absolutely. And then maybe, you know, once the first ascent, you can start, just like we see with Everest, you can start paring it down to, we'll be the first male or female, whoever climbs it first, be the
yeah.
first American or whatever your state is. You know, it's almost like getting a star named after you. Yeah, yeah, that's your star. Or you buy an acre of the moon, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. So like,
it's pretty neat, yeah.
That is interesting. What are some of the, who are some of the unsung either heroes or just lesser known players in the growth of this industry around Everest? Is there anyone's story that you came across that was like, I can't believe there's isn't more known about this person? I'm sure there's a lot, but is there anybody that just kind of rises to the top?
Well, it's a lot of Nepalis. Let's be honest. It's a lot of Sherpas, right? It's getting to know all those Sherpas who were there in the 90s as cooks and are there today as full-blown mountain guides, the best in the world. That's really interesting. Lok Barita, Purbatashi, you know, the Angdorji, like these are like legends on Everest that over it doesn't quite trickle down to the West who these people are. A lot of them, Funuru, these are all people who work for the guiding companies that are now even guiding international, which is kind of cool, right? Like Funuru for IMG, he guides Denali, he guides Kilimanjaro. That was another thing you never saw in the 90s and early 2000s. Again, it was just like, they're the locals, but they're like the, you know, MVPs for a lot of these companies now. And I'm trying to think, I mean, early on, everyone was pretty cooperative. You know, the people that I write about early on, Eric Simonson, Todd Burleson, Rob Hall and Gary Ball, they were all pretty integral to designing or developing the industry. I didn't realize how kind of hands-on they were in sort of driving the efficiency and working together and cooperating and stuff. And, you know, I'd say Everest for me, Dave Hahn, who's a Western guide, lives in New Mexico, who until Ketten Cool recently, he climbed more than any other Westerner, guiding people up and down. His deep understanding of that mountain and of guiding has had a huge, huge effect on the guiding industry, because he's been there since the very beginning. He doesn't guide there anymore. He retired in like 2017.
How has Everest or the view of Everest changed for the Nepali people? I know that the guides, there's, you know, the industry of the climbers and the guides in Nepal, but how about the average citizen? I mean, has it reflected the Western view of just seeing this, you know, super touristy attraction that has, you know, lost a lot of its glamour? Has it also been seen that way, or has it been different than our perspective?
It's very different. I quote Conrad Anker toward the end of the book. He's talking about how important Everest is to them. Nepal does not have a cricket team that competes against, you know, India or Pakistan, for example. It is their national symbol, sport. It's everything. And there are statues, right? He points out that there are statues of like the first female to climb it, you know, of course, Tenzing Norgay, all over Nepal. And in Kathmandu, it's their mountain. It's like that it has gotten so big and popular, and that they're now kind of more, they run it and they're now being recognized for it. It's actually a pretty big point of pride for them.
And has remained that way. Like it hasn't seems to continue to go that direction.
Their pride in the Nepali's pride in Everest is higher than ever, higher than ever. I mean, because it's run by Nepalis, the industry now, and some of these companies are so big. Are you aware of, I wonder how many of your listeners are aware of Nimsdai? You hear that name? So this guy, you know, a Nepali, former Gurkha, special forces, again, a badass. He started climbing late in life, something really recently. And then he was the it had been climbed before him in 7 years. Nimsdai came out and climbed it in 7 months, all 14 of the 8,000 meter peaks. Since then, he has started a guiding company, started a clothing company, and is incredibly famous across certainly Asia. He's on huge billboards in Asian cities, and, you know, he was sponsored by big companies like, you know, like Rolex or Osprey. But now, of course, he has his own company, so he's moved on from that. But I mean, he's a multimillionaire. He got knighted, or not knighted. He got an OBE from the British government. He is I would say, you know, the symbol. He's a little controversial and it rubs some people the wrong way, but he's the symbol of mountaineering in Nepal right now.
Since reclaiming the mountain, how have the guides, what are some of those innovations and developments that are coming along with the new generation of Sherpas, a new generation of guides? Is there a shift in mindset or a shift in philosophy that you've learned through this experience of writing this book? Or have you noticed what is kind of the shift happening?
Innovation's an interesting one, because I'd say this is probably what would spark the most debate these days. Because when you start to look at the innovations and the things that they've done on the mountain to increase the margin for error, decrease, you know, increase the safety net, there's a lot of eye rolling that you could do. You're sort of like, oh my gosh, like what's next? Are they going to put a gondola to the top? You know, because it's true. I mean, that's what they are essentially trying to do. They're trying to make the experience, since they've accepted and like the fact that everyone from all walks of life might be coming to climate and all layers of all levels of experience. But they're now saying, well, now we need to put in place systems where no one dies. Like, you know, that's what they're working toward. They're not doing that thing where they're trying to like, oh, Everest needs to be a little bit dangerous. They're not saying that. They're saying, what can we do to like minimize deaths to zero? And I think they just announced, for example, this year, they're always coming up with stuff, but this year they announced that every climber has to rent a tracking device, rent and wear a tracking device that can be so that you could be found by like a Sherpa climber or a, you know, a Western climber or a helicopter if they go looking for you, so that you're not just stranded, which is usually how you die.
You know, say there's a decade long stretch, there's no deaths. I don't know how realistic that is. Is that good or bad for the prestige or the allure of Everest?
Well, I would say it's good, especially good for the country of Nepal. And the reason is because we've already gone past the idea of it being quote unquote spoiled, right? I think that you're never going to convince a hardcore climber or an armchair climber who's really, you know, into the aesthetics of climbing and mountaineering that the mountain is not spoiled. You know, it is for climbers in a lot of ways, but it's become something different. It's not spoiled as a goal for sort of people the same way they might sign up for their first marathon or triathlon. So it's just completely turned into something different. And so now if they reduce deaths to zero, I kind of like that, like no one dies doing an Ironman normally. You know, there are very few deaths in Ironman. I'm kind of like the fact that people don't typically die running a marathon. That's a good thing. That's probably where I would, you know, walk in the same bucket I would put it in.
That makes sense. Yeah. And I'm definitely not advocating we need a few deaths to attract more people to Everest. I agree. For the families especially, I'm sure it would like there to be no deaths.
Yeah.
What would you say, something that's often criticized about this experience is the expense, just how expensive it is. Just basically you have to mortgage a home to go climb Everest. How do you see that shifting in the future with the changes that are happening now?
Well, it's becoming cheaper by a lot. I mean, the Nepali companies charge roughly half of what the Western companies charge. You know, there's some good reasons for that, and there's some questionable reasons for that. But, the above board stuff is the fact that the Nepali government gives them a lot of breaks, right? They don't have to pay for climbing permits. There's all this stuff they don't have to pay for, which can allow them to give that product for so much cheaper. So you're basically getting the same product with some of these companies, right? The really good ones that have amazing certified guides and they've been doing it for a long time. You're paying $40,000 to climb the mountain. Whereas if you want to go with one of the big well-known Western companies, it's going to be at least, you know, I don't know, 50, 60, and then upwards of 70. Some are charging over 100. And so it is getting cheaper. And the fact that the Western companies' business is slowing down significantly, I think their prices will either come down or they will begin to drop out of the Everest game. So it's not getting more expensive, put it that way.
Yeah, I've heard some folks say, you know, with the perception that Everest is, you know, you basically, if you can pay enough, you can get to the top. And I've heard a lot of people push back against that and say, no, it's no matter what, no matter how much money or how much help, it's still a very difficult thing to do, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. What was your understanding talking to people who've climbed it, talking to, you know, having been to base camp yourself? Tell us about the value or the difficulty of this challenge from an adventure point of view. Is it still an adventure to do Everest?
It really depends who you are. I mean, it's so hard to say. If you consider adventure, if something is only an adventure to you, if there's a certain level of risk, like there's a decent, you know, like a an acceptably high chance that you'll be harmed or die, then that has gone down significantly. If you listen to your guides and do what you're supposed to and take all the safety precautions, your chances of dying on Everest are very low. So if dying is one of the prerequisites, then no. If you are an Ironman triathlete who decides, or an ultra runner, that you want to go try Everest, I don't know this because I've never been that fit as one of them, but I'm guessing that they might tell you physically it was hard, but you know, they've done a lot of hard stuff. Speaking from my perspective, nothing drove that point home of just how hard it is like being at base camp for a few days. I felt awful. I've been a climber my whole adult life. I've climbed lots of mountains. I mean, I'm a very mid-level climber. Don't get me wrong. I'm no expert, but I've climbed lots of mountains, been at altitude. I've never been great at altitude, but this was next level because I was sleeping at 17,500 feet, you know, trying to drum up an appetite, walking around base camp, talking to people. It was rough going. And I knew that I don't know if I could climb Mount Everest. That's something that I like to relay to people, that if you just automatically think you can, I don't know. I'm shocked if at people who do think that. I think I might be able to, you know, if I train long enough. But honestly, when I hear about what it takes to go from above camp to, I'm not positive I could climb it. And so, I mean, what can I say to people who do succeed? You know, I have to admit that that ability to dig deep and find that next gear and do it, accomplish it, I don't know, it's pretty incredible to me.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's cowboy boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and the friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, that's fine. Just go to tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots as well as free returns and exchanges. They ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today and get ready for this summer. If you ever thought, can I pull off a pair of cowboy boots? Then you should pull on a pair of Tecovas and you'll see. They'll become your new favorite footwear. Cowboys knew what they were doing when they invented this Western wear. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
So with a lot of these challenges, and with being overcrowded or being too many amenities or too much waste, I know they just implemented, didn't they just implement a human waste, you have to bag it out now? Isn't that a rule?
That's right.
Yep.
So that's another rule.
There's a lot of changes happening. What do you think is a necessary change that will need to be implemented in the future to continue making this, you know, sustainable or something that holds its prestige?
That's a great question. That's a tricky one because, again, I hate to second guess the Nepali's own policies and what they want to do. You know, that's the, you know, they know best what is good for their industry. But at the same time, for probably decades now, they've been talking about limiting climbing permits. That would probably not be a bad thing. So every year, you know, only a certain amount of people are allowed to go up Everest. At the moment, it's a little bit of a free for all.
Are there no limits right now?
I don't believe there are any limits right now. I don't believe, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But if there are, it doesn't even meet the amount that go there, or it's beyond the amount that go there. So we haven't hit it yet. And a lot of smart people have advocated for there being a limit. and it being lower than how many people visit. That's obviously less revenue for a lot of these guiding companies. Nepali companies, for example, who bring, say, 100 clients in one season, it would be harder for them. And they might look at it purely from a bottom line sense, and so they might resist it. But it would only be a good thing to have fewer people on the mountain. You know, I know Conrad Anker, you know, our sort of greatest mountaineer in this country. He talks a lot about like a carrying capacity study, which is done on mountains a lot, right? Was done on Denali, for example. They say, how many people can the mountain handle when it comes to waste, presence, resources for rescues and all this kind of stuff? And they come up with a number, and that's how many they allow on the mountain every climbing season. And it's pretty smart. It's a good way to manage a mountain. We also have a lot of, you know, we have a lot of like benefits here in the West to be able to do stuff like that. You could do something similar on Everest. You could actually study how much waste it can take in a season, et cetera. But that we're probably far off from that. That's not easy to do.
You know, as you talk about this, it reminds me of a lot of stories here in the States or in the West where we've just learned from the error of our ways. Maybe, you know, learning about management of the national park system, you know, not letting people pet animals, not letting people go to the bathroom anywhere they want, not letting vendors just crowd the shores and the banks of Niagara Falls. You know, there's so many things that people can tell you these stories from the past, and it's just unbelievable what used to happen. Do you think exactly. We'll look back on Everest in 50 years, say, or 100 years with a lot of these same kind of feelings that we do now? Like they used to let people just ride the bison in Yellowstone. Are you kidding me? I don't think they actually did. But, you know, like that wouldn't have surprised me with, you know, talking about just how different things were then. Or fire suppression, another one that we're dealing with now is like, yeah, for years they just didn't have fires in places that would have naturally had them. Do you think that's where Everest is headed, where we're getting so far beyond some of these tropes and challenges and missteps today that in 50 years we're going to be in a much better place with where the mountain is, what the experience is, and what, you know, your average climber, the adventure they have while they're there?
You know, I'm not so sure. And I think it's the thing that people forget about most, the Nepal factor, right? That's an incredibly poor country. And a lot of our developments and evolutions in the area you're talking about come from the luxury of being able to do those things and, you know, having scientific research about it, you know, at hand. And Nepal's facing different challenges than we are. And so I just don't know if it would have to come from them. Everyone I've spoken to agrees it would have to come from them. It's not like some Western team can show up and say, here's what we think. That's been tried. It's considered disrespectful. And it's really hard to say whether any of that stuff you just talked about will float to the top as a priority enough that things will start to actually change, say, within our lifetime in that respect. That said, another one of the big surprises in this process was the experience of going to Everest Base Camp. I mean, again, I've hiked and climbed all over the world many times. I had even been to Nepal before and trekked over on the Annapurna side. It is so beautiful and so well managed. And it is just such an incredible adventure that's accessible to just about anyone to do that trek from Lukla at 9,000 feet up to Everest Base Camp at 17,500. Takes about 10 days. And, you know, I know it's a bucket list thing for a lot of people, but I was blown away I was sort of ready, you know, am I going to see candy wrappers on the side? Am I going to, you know, is it going to be just crowded, you know, giant groups of German tourists, you know, like I just wasn't sure what to expect. And I mean, it was just so incredible. I want to bring my family, my wife and kids back sort of as soon as possible. And you know, and I looked at that and I thought, then the first thing I thought that soaked in as I was making that trek was, wow, the Nepalis really care, or the Sherpas, specifically the Sherpas who are native to the Khumbu Valley, that I should give them props specifically. They really care about this area.
If you were at a, say you're at a bar or something, and you hear a table talking about Everest and sharing a bunch of these misconceptions or headlines that have been beaten dead, and you interjected, what's a couple things you would share with them to try to put into perspective your understanding of Everest? What are those high level, you would interject with this, what would those be?
Well, for starters, having written the book, I would have to refrain. I'd have to stop myself from getting way in the weeds and nerding out to the point that they're just like, hey, can you beat it? We're trying to have a beer here. But if I was going to go in with the main thing, I would say I would probably talk about this, this sort of turn of events with the Sherpas, the Nepalis, how much pride they take in the industry now, and how that's kind of all that matters. I don't know if I mean that literally, but do you get what I'm saying about, you know, the Nepalis own the industry now. It's theirs, whether it goes bad or good. And there's something poetic about that they have ended up with that stewardship and that ownership. And there's a ton of pride in Nepal. And I would almost say that a lot of that, I would hope, would erase this idea that A, Everest is a mess. Maybe it was at one time, but it's not right now. And that, you know, and that the industry is despicable, right? Because there's just kind of so much good that is coming from the industry at the moment. I think I would go there just to put it in a nutshell, you know. And if they're serious climbers, there's probably no changing their mind. And yeah, I don't know that I would go further than that. I might bring up the conga line photo. That's probably the most famous photo. And it's kind of fun to dismantle. It's kind of fun to dismantle what people got wrong about that photo, why the photo isn't what it seems.
Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah. So a couple things there that are, I think, are really interesting is, so weather forecasting on Everest has become insanely good. It's so crazy how good it is. There are professional weather forecasters that just do Everest, like in Belgium and, you know, different countries. It's like a tiny industry. And then the companies pay these people to give them these reports. And what they're looking for is a keyhole, right? They're looking for the periods of stability between storms. So they're looking for a summit window, as it's often referred to. And what happens is you're sitting around base camp for weeks and weeks and weeks. And a lot of times what will happen is all of a sudden people will hear of the first summit window. And everyone will say, hey, did you hear? There's a summit window on May 3rd. And what will happen is you got to count backwards for how long it's going to take you to get up to camp four, right? It's going to take about 5-6 days to get to camp four before you can make that bid. And especially among the inexperienced Everest guides, the less experienced, the ones that maybe shouldn't be on the mountain, the companies that are a little less professional, the companies that are just not as well organized, because they exist. I don't want to make it sound like every company on the mountain is, you know, this awesome, tightly run ship. There's some questionable companies that shouldn't be there. What happens is there's a tendency to take that very first weather window. Everyone makes a mad dash for the summit the very first window. And that's why you get those huge crowds. The crowds are dangerous. Yes, that's true. You're spending an awful lot of time in the death zone, which can just kill someone just in itself, just being there for 2 hours longer than they should have. But most of the guides and the guide companies that do send people up for the summit on those days, they've actually accounted for the extra 2 hours in the line. Now, I agree that if it was me, I would just opt to not go up. But the ones who do opt to go, they have extra, the Sherpas have extra oxygen for them, and they've accounted for the extra time it's going to take. So it's a little more managed than it looks. And then the other piece, I think the more compelling, more powerful piece is that in talking to the Western guides who were there in 2019, that year of the photo, I think at least four or five of them, of the big ones, you know, Garrett Madison, maybe Lydia Brady was there, Kiwi that year, all told me they had the summit to themselves with their clients. So in other words, they said, oh, I was up there with one person, or I was up there with two clients, all to myself, didn't see another person the whole time. And the reason is because if you're really experienced, if you're a really good Everest guide, you have kind of patience to wait for the third, maybe fourth weather window. It's difficult because your clients are going batshit crazy. They're like, if we miss the first one and then don't get another one, you can imagine they've spent all this money. But the really good Everest guides, they know when the next keyhole, or they know there's going to be another one, and they know exactly which one to pick. And there you go. A bunch of them brought clients to the top in complete solitude. I mean, I don't know what else, you know, it says it all, right? That was 2019. Some people had that experience in the Conga line, and a bunch of other people didn't. And that's all about which guiding company you choose, which guides you choose, what decisions your guides make. And that's on the client, in my opinion.
Wow. I'm not totally sure what led to Nepal taking over the mountain. How did that shift happen?
Oh boy, probably not great as a last question, because that's might be the biggest can of worms of the guiding era.
Maybe we'll save that for the book then.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe save it for the book. But it really was sparked by an event in 2014. That was like the watershed moment. It had been brewing for a while. 16 Sherpas were killed in an avalanche in the icefall, and they boycotted the season. And they shut the season down. It was over. No one climbed Everest that year. I mean, one or two people did. They weren't supposed to. And I mean, that was devastating. It was devastating to the Sherpa families that counted on the money, the Westerners, of course, the clients, who showed up to climb that year and were ready and trained for a year. It shook it up enough that the wheels went into motion to change things there. And things had been changing a little bit already. More Sherpas had been getting certified, but a lot changed after that year.
Well, if you want to learn more about it, get the book Everest Inc. It's coming out April 16th, 2024. We'll aim this to come out probably right after that, so that we make sure folks can click on the link and get it. And anything else you want to share? Where would you like folks to get it? Where would you like folks to follow along and learn more about you?
These days getting these books is so easy. It's all the obvious stuff, right? Amazon and your local bookstore would probably be my preference. I'm probably going to start posting more on my Instagram in the run-up to this Everest season. Right. Let's not forget, Everest season starts in about a month. And that's when people start heading over again to do this whole thing again. And I'm going to be paying particular attention to it with what happened last year. I'm very curious. Having written the book and made some assumptions, you know, I'm curious to see how things unfold. And I'll probably start to follow that story as sort of a epilogue to my book on my Instagram in the next maybe 4 weeks.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining the Adventure Sports Podcast. This was really interesting. I hope it was a good conversation for you.
Oh, it was great, Mason. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for the support. Oh, no worries. It was fun to talk.
Great. All right. Well, thank you. That's a wrap. I'll let you know if we need anything else, and I'll edit all this I coughed a handful of times. I think I muted myself.
Yeah, good. I'm glad we're there.
Sweet. All right. Well, good stuff. Great job. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, thanks, Mason.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to growing the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.